Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on a telephone. First day I've had telephone use. Don't have computer yet or internet. But I'll be doing my program nonetheless every day until full power is restored. In post-recovery from the hurricane, where we got slammed with 150-mile-an-hour winds, and I'll be doing a follow-up tomorrow evening on the Progressive Comedy Hour. We had the largest listenership in the program's history last week on how to prepare for disaster. But as I was in the disaster, not able to take calls, now I'll be able to take calls tomorrow and explain all the different questions you had. So you won't want to miss tomorrow, 7 p.m. Today, I'm going to begin with the latest on melatonin, a very important nutrient. And the National Defense Medical Center of Taiwan has some good study. Also, the cannabinoids. Now, we're talking about the non-psychotropic, not what you smoke, but the essential oil that you would take and what disease it helps with from the University of Arizona. And a new study finds that you get a real big increase in birth defects if you're living near industrial agriculture, and a lot of people in the United States do, and are not even aware of it. University of California, Santa Barbara. And also teaching people to visualize an outcome is more effective than teaching people what to do. University of Manchester, and a whole lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to shift gears. I'm going to do two commentaries today. One from Chris Hedges, The Great Flood, and one I'm doing myself on why we have a hard time as a society. Individuals, of course, can, but as a society in learning the lessons of our crisis. Also today, we're going to have some audio clips, and I'm going to tell you how to boil water today. I think you know, well, this will be a little different. And remember about 6 months ago, I was talking about my projections forward based upon trends. I see that one of the biggest sectors that are going to be hit are the financial service industries. Now, there was a time recently when you had over 150,000 people just in New York City working in that industry. These were the so-called best and brightest in the Ivy League schools, the MBAs, some Harvard Wharton School of Business. Well, according to the latest information, they are going to take an enormous hit. Quote, and this is from the former CEO of Citigroup. 30% of jobs at risk in the banking automation. Wow, that's a whole lot of people. If you add that up clear across America, you're talking about several million people. And these are people who are not qualified in anything else. They put it all in plan A. There was no plan B. What do you do? So what can we do to help those people? And I'll give you some ideas on that. And what I consider is the obsoleteness of college education and the worthlessness of degrees for many, but not all, college students. Well, I believe the last thing anyone should do today is go to college, unless, and then I'll explain the caveat, otherwise you're just wasting your time, you're wasting your life, you're getting into debt, you're never going to get out of that debt, you're not going to have a job when you get out, you're not going to have a job when you do get in the field that you were educated in. So what the hell are you thinking? Oh, I forgot. We're a society that suspended critical thinking. We react like drones. So there's a cost to pay for that, and I'll get into that. And what are the options, and what can you do so at least you have no debt and have a chance of a livelihood and a future? So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. There's a nutrient that manufactures itself in a tiny little gland in the middle of the brain. It's about the size of a grape seed, and it's called the melatonin nutrient from the pineal gland. And according to researchers, they've examined the potential benefits of melatonin. That's the hormone made by that gland that allows us to have a good immune system at night. That's why if you're not having a good night's sleep, you're not producing melatonin. And without the deep rapid eye movement sleep for about 2 hours, you're going to wake up fatigued. Your immune system's not going to be restored. Your energy will not be highly anabolic. You're going to be dragging yourself through the day. So you can take 1 to 2 milligrams about 4 hours before going to bed at night of melatonin. And here's what it does. Oh, yeah, it'll help you sleep. Quote, for treating blood cancer such as leukemia and lymphoma, melatonin works. They point to evidence that melatonin boosts the immune response against cancer cells, inhibits cancer cell growth, and protects healthy cells from the toxic effects of chemotherapy. And because melatonin is also involved in regulating circadian rhythms, which help coordinate and synchronize internal body functions, timing of melatonin treatments is critical to the anti-cancer effect. This is from the British Journal of Pharmacology. Quote, we hope this information will be helpful in the design of studies related to therapeutic effects of melatonin. I hope so. Now, I've looked at the scientific literature, and it is abundant. More than 22,000 peer-reviewed articles on PubMed alone, and many in our Library of Medicine, which is the government's official database. Now, this just shows you how schizophrenic things are. On the one hand, the government says if you use or distribute or in any way align yourself with marijuana, that you should be put in prison for a long period of time, unless, of course, you're George Bush or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, in which case you get a pass. Amazing, the hypocrisy. But everything in America is hypocritical, as we all know. People say one thing, do just the opposite. Promise you, and then do just the opposite. But then they say there's no benefit. And I've got 22,500 studies on their website. So if you've got 22,500 studies on your website showing how it impacts seizures and brain cancer and lung cancer, then why aren't you sharing that? Well, then that's the politics, because then you got this big, gigantic agency, which is the whole drug enforcement agency, and so it's making money. Remember, illegal narcotics are very profitable. About 2% of the money stays with the farmers or the people that make the drugs, the poppy farmers in Afghanistan, which make the drug for heroin, or the coca plants that make the drug for cocaine. But 98% of that money is made in the country by the dealers and the franchise distributors. So what if you made it legal? You took away the profit motive? Well, all those people would no longer have money from that form of organized crime and beheadings, and 140,000 disappeared and assumed dead or dead in Mexico alone just in the last 10 years. None of it makes any sense. There's not a single rational argument that you could make to overlook all the good science on the cannabinoids, but it makes a lot of sense when you look at the multi-billion dollar drugs that are used to treat pain, and the cannabinoids would be competing and without addiction. And it makes sense if you're looking at chemotherapy versus cannabinoids. Chemotherapy, $300,000 a year. Cannabinoids, around $5,000 a year. $5,000, natural, non-toxic, $300,000, and that doesn't include the flowers or the price of a toe tag in the morgue. Our entire cancer industry is just one gigantic scam, and we all should know that. If you don't, it's because you don't want to. If you do, then look and you'll see the truth of it. We failed in our war on cancer, our war on drugs, our war on poverty, our war on terror, our war on crime. Well, we failed in all of our wars because we shouldn't be having wars. We should be healing and preventing. But that takes diplomacy and spiritual values, and we don't have that. We got Dick Cheney, and we got the other people who are hard-ass war hawks, left and right, conservative and liberal. It doesn't matter. Pick your bullet. They're both going to kill someone, and they're both locked and loaded. So along comes the cannabinoids. According to the University of Arizona, some cancers love bone. They thrive in its nutrient-rich environment while gnawing away at the very substrate that sustains them, all the while releasing inflammatory substances that cause pain. Pain so severe that opiates are prescribed to allay the agony. But opiates recently have been denounced for their addictive nature. Over the summer, the nation's opiate crisis was declared a national emergency. And long before that, University of Arizona had been seeking ways to create alternative analgesics. And a group of scientists are now seeing promise in a specific area, a class of chemicals, the compounds that I've mentioned many times on the air, that can relieve pain brought about by metastatic breast cancer. And those compounds are unique. They're not, I repeat, they're not psychotropic, meaning they're not addictive. These are the chemicals of the cannabinoids, canna, C-A-N-N-A, bi, B-I, noids, N-O-I-D-S, cannabinoids. In other words, they do not bring about the euphoria typically associated with cannabinoids or the cannabis. And what's more, or the opiates, these particular chemical compounds help slow bone loss, unlike opiates, while slowing the proliferation of the cancer. So, this was published in Neuropharmacology in the current issue. Relieve pain, slow down the cancer, and stay healthy. That is what our government is not showing us. But, and by the way, when people say, marijuana contains over 400 different chemical compounds, with only one or two being tested for medicinal use. So we have a lot of room here to grow in our scientific knowledge of cannabinoids. But we do know they slow the spread of brain and colon cancer and slow down the spread of breast cancer. So what it does, it slows the whole process of the cancer down, and therefore you can build up your immune system. Modified citrus pectin, indole-3-carbinol, I3C, and the isothiocyanates, eating broccoli sprouts, chlorophyll, spirulina, ginger, garlic, onion. That's what kills the cancer cells. So in effect, this slows it down, so then you can get the strength to destroy it naturally. From Tilburg and Erasmus University there in the Netherlands, they found that the human lifespan has limits. Here's what this says. Quote, Dutch researchers claimed to have discovered the maximum age ceiling for human lifespan. Despite growing life expectancy because of better nutrition, living conditions, and medical care. They looked at 75,000 Dutch people whose exact ages were recorded at the time of death, and they said that the maximum lifespan for a female is 115 years and 7 months. Men are almost there, 114 years and 1 month. Quote, on average, people live longer, but the very oldest among us have not gotten older over the last 30 years. There is certainly some kind of wall here. Of course, the average life expectancy has increased. And he said, pointing out the number of people turning 95 in the Netherlands has almost tripled. Quote, nevertheless, the maximum ceiling hasn't changed, end quote. I agree and I disagree. We had a French woman, Jean Helment, who died at the age of 122 and 164 days. She remains the oldest verified woman to date. And, however, I do not take any of the biblical or the allegorical historical lives seriously, how long someone lived. Moses would have to be over 500 years to have lived through the time period that he is attested to do all the things he did. And the Chinese man who supposedly lived 222 years, we don't really have proof of that. But here's where they're wrong. They're using a normal standard of living as their index, meaning if you take everyone in a country, let's say you take every sample of 75,000, that's a pretty good sample. That means that you have not taken into consideration how many of them smoked or how many of them drank or how many exercised or didn't exercise, how many were vegan versus meat eater, how much meat did they eat and how did they eat the meat, what kind of meat did they eat. Norway has abundant fish. How many ate fish and what kind of fish and how often? They do not have a lot of fresh vegetables because their seasons are not. Beautiful as country as it is, they do not have the same season. I remember when I was in those countries, Switzerland and Sweden, and I went into the country and I found tiny little strawberries. And when I say tiny, I'm talking about the size of a little green pea, you know, like little ones you put in your soup. And it was that tiny, and yet it tasted almost like sugar. It was very sweet. Why? Because the growing season is so short, it does not have the time to mature the maturation of natural sugars from carbohydrates to simple sugar within the plant through photosynthesis. And sometimes in these countries that have high elevations, like in the whole tundra and going across the steppes of Russia and in through the boreal forest of the north altitude, you'd be lucky to be able to get something fresh in August because it will be cold until that time. Very few things really grow, especially in the way of fruits. So a lot of it's imported. Now, so if you take away the amount of servings of fruits and vegetables fresh, you could impact your life span right there alone by 10 years, just 10 years. And I know people in Bedouin communities and arid communities that just don't have all the fruits and vegetables they should have. They take what they have available, and they limit it to that. And then you see them, you know, having very weathered skin and weathered faces, and well, their insides are weathered also, based upon a very limited diet. Stress is another thing. How much stress does a person have in their daily lives? That itself could be about 10 years of aging, pro or con. Genetics is the least of it. Exercise, how much exercise, what type of exercise? One of the greatest, if not the greatest, female runner in history, Greta Weitz. She won more New York City marathons, more top marathons around the world than any other woman before. I knew Greta. In fact, I helped her when she got her infamous diarrhea and during a marathon. But she died young. Why? Overtraining. And until that point, I remember sitting with Peter Roth. Peter and I started the Natural Living Running Walk Club. I started in 1977, and Peter came on board in 1979, and it's still going to this day. In fact, just 3 weeks ago, I was in New York in the park with the runners. Just keep going. We've had almost 30,000 do the New York City Marathon. But I took the body chemistry once. I did it once. And I could do it because we had all the physicians and nurses and we had the labs. So we got 100 people doing the New York City Marathon from our club. I think we had 400 or 500 that year. And we took their blood chemistries and saliva and everything about the person. Now, mind you, all these people, there might have been some exceptions, but all these people had something in common. They were vegan or vegetarian. They had low body mass index, meaning low body fat weight, generally around 7 to 8%. They didn't drink alcohol. They hadn't smoked, or at least I can only refer to what they've told me, if they're being honest. And they ate very healthy, and they supplemented with different nutrients before and after. Because one of the very first things I explain to people when we're doing training is, if you want to keep in top condition, you needn't do more than 3 miles a day. That's it. You do 3 miles a day with intervals, meaning you go as fast as you can for a half mile, then you recover, then fast and recover. You do 3 miles a day. You do around 18, maybe 20 miles a week. You'll stay in top shape. When you start training for racing or long distance training, you'll get stronger and faster. You'll also shorten your lifespan. unless you compensate, because you're prematurely aging those cells. Now we look at a lot of these at one time great athletes, and by the time they're in their 40s or 50s, their bodies are generally a wreck. Their immune systems are a wreck because they didn't compensate. We still have people racing, myself, Sid Howard, Thelma Wilson, Sam Skinner, and these are not easygoing people when it comes to racing. They're world-class athletes. And the reason why they're still able to compete into their 70s and to their 60s and 70s is because they compensate. So the big factor missing in this Netherlands study is compensation. If you just do long-distance training, you're prematurely aging your telomeres. When you do a little bit of exercise, you're lengthening the telomeres. When you do a long amount, you're shortening them. When you don't take your antioxidants, you're creating oxidative stress, a huge amount of free radicals, and the free radicals then damage your cell. The cell doesn't have what it needs to repair fully, so you won't notice it for 5, 10, 15 years. But then one day, you can't do it anymore. You think, well, what happened to it? I used to have it. I don't have it anymore. You used it up, and you didn't compensate. It's like a lot of things in life. We do not maintain a sense of balance in what we do, and as a result, then we overdo something out of passion, out of fear, out of insecurity, until one day, what we could have had we lived in balance, we've lost. And then we live with our remorse and our regret and our anger about it, or get depressed. So there is no accurate maximum lifespan at this moment. That will only happen when they take a group of people who are vegan, exercising, and compensating, de-stressing, taking the right supplements, and have a love for life. Now you've got a group to compare others, the normal person, to. And until you do that, then these studies are really, they're just markers. You know, you can use them, but the day will come when you're using NAD and PPQ and all the state-of-the-art nutrients we know today actually reverse damage to our cells. Well, none of the people in, you know, that country, no one over there is using them. They're not using them in Poland or Sweden or Norway or Denmark, none of those countries. First, because they frequently don't allow vitamins unless by prescription because of Codex Alimentarius harmonized the use of supplements. You literally, if you want to take a zinc, 10 milligrams, you have to go to a doctor and get a prescription. Then you have to go buy it, and you could pay $30 for what should be $2. When we tried to fight the Codex Alimentarius, they wouldn't allow us to bring our data. I remember asking, could I come as an expert witness? And I had 500,000, let me repeat that, 500,000 studies on the nutrients they want to regulate and showing the efficacy, safety, high range, and chemistry of vitamin C and E and all these other nutrients, all from peer-reviewed literature. But of course, had they allowed me to testify, had my evidence been presented, then they couldn't say, oh, you only need 1.1 milligrams of B1. It would, the study, the proponents of the studies would have just blown open that whole myth that we need tiny little amounts of these nutrients. So the pharmaceutical industry's footprints was all over this. They had their bases covered, so people weren't taking supplements in these countries and staying healthy. They would get sick and then rely upon their drugs. Sounds cynical, but it's true. So we have, at least up to this point, we have the right to take our supplements. Take your supplements based upon quality input, hopefully from a dietitian or nutritionist who has background in the field who can help you see what do you need, how much do you need, what do you have too much of, what do you have too little of. So then I'm stating, I believe that if you did it right, there's no reason that the person couldn't live to be over 130 in good health. But we just haven't had that generation yet do that. Just a thought. Now, also, there's a study from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and it's an exhaustive study, and it's sounding the alarm over industrial pesticide use and its effects on human health. And what it's saying is it's pregnant women in California's San Waukegan Valley have a significantly greater chance of premature birth or birth abnormalities if they live near agricultural fields that are being sprayed. And that's almost everybody who lives around the farming area. And if you've ever driven up California, beautiful state to drive, especially over by the coast, but even inland, you're going up through their fertile valley where a lot of the produce in America is grown. And you can drive for miles and miles and miles. You can drive for several hours. And you're just driving through all these different lettuce fields and peach orchards and almond trees, orchards by the thousands. They spray all that, heavily spread, with planes. And planes, of course, are going to spray, and they don't come right down on these crop dusters, spray in the air. Air currents can carry those pesticides for miles. Even organic farms have found that there's residuals of pesticides that have come in on the air from these spraying. So now people live around these. There's whole communities. The whole area has been developed. So most people don't go out and drive around to see how close they are to an agricultural section. Or they might even think it's cool. Well, we're right up behind a big farm. Not if you realize the water in that area is going to be polluted, because all farm water is polluted, all of it. Tens of millions of people have wells that have industrial chemicals in the wells at levels that are not safe. So here's the irony, and I leaked that, someone at the EPA gave it to me, and we put it out on the air when that first came out, that 59 million Americans were drinking from wells that were considered contaminated, so they couldn't get the contamination out of the well, so they simply raised the threshold that your body was supposed to be able to tolerate. Completely unscientific. Like a baby is supposed to be able to tolerate the same amount of pesticides from water that a 300-pound football player. A person who's got immune-compromised conditions is supposed to be able to tolerate the same amount of a pesticide as a vegan, and it's just not the case. This is the deception and the corruption within these governmental agencies. So, if you're going to live around a farm, you better do your homework and see what are they growing, what are they spraying, and do you have anything that you can see as being negatively impacted. University of Manchester, which is in the United Kingdom, they gave us something to think about. Now, it's an established but little-known psychological theory that is likely to improve performances across a range of activities, including sports. According to this new published, it can be applied to amateurs or skilled performers alike. Many philosophers believe that all behaviors are predetermined and have a causal lineage. Some of the factors believed to influence determinism include genetics, I disagree, environment, I agree, and past and present experiences, absolutely agree. Well, they performed a couple of simple experiments to test how we experience choices. And the key is, what role does memory play in directing our attention to specific details in our surroundings? And the results of what was called perceptual control theory experiments have demonstrated that an organism controls neither its own behavior nor external environment variables, but rather its own perceptions of those variables. So actions are not controlled, they're varied so as to cancel the effects that unpredictable environmental disturbances would otherwise have on controlled perceptions. And according to the standard catchphrase in the field, behavior is the control of perception. So the theory argues that when trying to improve performance, teaching people what to do, and that's what we do, is actually less effective than teaching people how to picture the outcome. So higher-level control systems often are able to use known strategies, which are themselves acquired through prior reorganizations, to seek perceptions that don't produce the conflict. Normally, this takes place without notice. If the conflict persists, and let's say the systematic problem-solving of higher systems fails, the reorganization system may modify existing systems until they bypass the conflict or until they produce a reference signal, a goal. So to make it real simple, I'll give you an example. Let's say that we are teaching people how to run a mile, and then we show them form and breathing and body motion, how high to pick up the legs so you don't jam your knees. That's what we do now as a society. We show people how to do something. What they're saying here is show them what the outcome will be if they keep their focus upon the outcome. And I started doing this a long time ago when we were training for the marathon, and we had huge groups. I mean, if you go up on the website, GaryNall.com, and you look under photographs, you'll see, I'm guessing, 400 or 500 photographs that have been sent in by runners over the years. And you'll see some 500-600 people gathered around on a Sunday morning learning about this. And one of the things we would do a guided visualization where they're just standing there with their eyes closed, and we show them how to run a marathon in their mind. And then we do this over and over again every Sunday until when they're actually in the marathon, they understand what they have to do because they keep seeing the marathon in their mind, and they've already conditioned their legs to follow their mind. And that's why not a single person that's ever been trained by us has not finished the New York Marathon and done it well, meaning, you know, they feel good at the end. So it's that completion. Now, that's running. Let's take something else. Let's take writing a book or writing an article or writing an essay or writing a poem. It's not just the technique that you can learn, and a lot of people can show you technique. It's showing you the outcome and the outcome of what you ideally want to create. And you start your journey at the conclusion, not the beginning. So you see it all. You see every single aspect of what you want to do. Now, once you see it all and you're confident in getting there and you know what's going to happen when you get there, now simply bring it back step by step to your first step. Then proceed. Having that vision, having that insight into the conclusion, to the completion, makes an enormous difference. Now, why is that important? Because so many people end up with writer's block, or they something happens in their journey of doing something, and then they get waylaid, they get sidetracked, they get disappointed. Oh, woe's me! And now they're blocked. They're into a fearful gridlock, and it's tightening. It's like fear and insecurity tightens us. We can't think. We can't breathe. Where the love of what we're doing, the happiness, the joy, the excitement expands us. We feel alive. We feel free. We feel energized when we expand. Look at the people in your lives, or maybe it's you, who are always looking ahead at what you want to achieve, and then following that, you're going to be getting to your goal far more effortlessly than the person that's irking, jerking from point to point, never knowing what the next step will be completely, or never having the confidence it's going to get there, and then they stop midway, and then they just abandon it. How many wonderful dreams, ideals, and ideas have we abandoned along the way? So it's just another way of looking at life. So this means your perception becomes your reality. And for those who are highly anal, where everything has to be 1, 2, 3, 4, good luck getting out of that. Because if we're ever going to get rid of fear and insecurity and open ourselves up to our ideals, you have to live in the area of quantum perception, meaning in one thought, you go from 0 to 3,000 miles an hour. You transverse all these limitations and problems because you put your perception in front of you, so you always know what you're following. Every time you look up, there's a rainbow. As long as you can do that, you can achieve things you never, not otherwise would have thought possible. And by the way, when someone comes to see me is terminally ill, I never talk about their cancer or their AIDS or their heart disease. Never. I talk about the joy of what they would like to do that they haven't done yet up to this point in their life. And then they get this kind of, we came here, I brought my sister here because, you know, she's been given 3 weeks to live and, you know, it was hospice care. And I said, no, let's try you. And what are you saying? I don't understand this. And I said, what I'm saying is, why don't you not talk? Why don't you let your sister here talk? Now, what is it you haven't done in your life you'd love to do? If you had if there was no no's, only yes. No one could stop you. No one could shame you. No one could diminish you. No one could limit you. No one could control you. What then would you do with your life? Oh, gee, there's so many things. I just never share them. I don't want to be ridiculed. You don't have to worry now. Just lay it out there. And suddenly all this starts flowing out, all these wonderful ideas. The other person, a relative, this anal person, they're wanting, you know, I thought I was going to get 6,000, you know, pages of protocol. My protocol is to smile today. When was the last time you smiled, buddy? You look at someone who's dying. They could use a smile. They could use a hug. They could use a rainbow. And get their mind away from death, dying, in completeness over. Because where you put your ideas, that becomes your reality. You got to put your ideas in a positive place to have a positive outcome. So that's why perception that is positive is so important. You keep dragging stuff in from the backyard that should have been buried. Now you're in conflict. Doubt, fear, guilt, shame, insecurity, all that then becomes your projection. And that's just a big, empty, black void. So let's put lightness into our life. That's the latest on health and healing. We are over halfway through our program. I'm Gary Nall, taking a brief break and coming right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Just a little program announcement. I'm a couple weeks away from spending time doing a lot of filming, lots of writing, perfecting some recipes that you'll all be able to see in the spring, and doing a new documentary, and helping some people in their journey of health and happiness. We're full. We have no more room. I'm sorry that a lot of people were calling last week and we had to say no, but there's just no more room. However, I am interested in helping everyone who wants to be helped all over the world. I'm going to do that in the spring with a worldwide health support group. Just want to let you know that'll happen then. Until then, my schedule's a little packed. But if you are a person who has made remarkable improvements or been cured of some medical condition that no one thought was possible, maybe maintenance but not cure, you reversed it. No matter who helped you, not just me, but whoever did, we'd like to hear your story. We'd like to hear what you have to say. Now, you've been listening to some doctors, regular doctors, board certified, not superstars, not public personas, just people who had the courage to change how they view medicine and healing. And I've been sharing their stories on the air. Now I want to talk about people, the patients. So no matter where you live, if you've reversed diseases that no one believed you could reverse from a medical doctor or homeopath, whatever technique, or even my own protocols, give Valerie in our office a call, because over the next 3 weeks, she's going to select a couple days and bring people in to hear their stories. My number is 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. For people who have made major improvements, maybe from diabetes till they're not diabetic, high blood pressure to no high blood pressure, gangrene to no gangrene, cancer to no cancer, something that is a remarkable turnaround. Now it's the person, not the doctor, to tell their stories, and then I'll share these on the air. Okay? And so give us a call and just ask for Valerie at 646-926-5422, or you can email prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com. And you'll be contacted within the next week, and then we'll have a time for you to come in or record you, so everybody can share in your journey of health and healing. We need to heal as a nation, and I believe we can. People are. It's just that our institutions, most of our institutions, are not there in support of how healing should exist. They claim they are, but they're not. The National Cancer Institute, the FDA, the CDC, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the National Institute of Mental Health. These are not agencies that are actually helping reverse disease. They're funded by billions of dollars. Industries then use them to legitimize their pharmaceuticals, but they're not healing people either. But lifestyle behavior does heal. Now, that's not to suggest that medicines are not important, that sometimes they are, or emergency medicine, absolutely exemplary. But we have been failed. Now look at our other agencies. The agencies that should be helping us prevent storms are not helping us prevent anything. For anyone paying attention, there is a storm that we don't know yet, but it'll be hitting at some power. We don't know whether it'll be a tropical depression, a Category 1, a hurricane, but it's going to be hitting in 2 days, possibly Long Island or somewhere up the East Coast of the United States. People are unprepared for it. People in Houston were unprepared. The rich didn't have to worry. All those buildings and their windows are coded for hurricane, Category 4 hurricane, in fact. But the 99% of people not living in those buildings, but living in small homes, many of them having been transplanted from Louisiana and down around New Orleans or Baton Rouge over to Houston, those living in trailer parks, 100% unprepared. Now, what would have been the solution? Let me tell you how simple this is. The United States government should have had at least 10 million gallons of gasoline in at least 1,000 tankers stationed a week before the storm in every city in Texas that would have been susceptible to the storm, or in Florida also, and Louisiana. We should have also had gigantic portable generators. These are flatbed generators. They could generate enough power to run a hospital or a clinic or a nursing home. There was no reason for 8 people to have died in a nursing home, but without water and electricity, let me tell you, I've been sleeping at 88 degrees with no fan, no air conditioning, nothing, and it's not easy to do. And then you go outside in the daytime, and it's 90 degrees, and it's 100% humidity. And try working in those, but you have no choice. If you're young and healthy, you can do it. If you're older and healthy, you can do it. If you're sick, you're not going to survive. We could have kept generators going in all the cities that would have been susceptible. We chose not to. We could have also sent down bottled water, millions of gallons, and put them into stadiums, football stadiums, soccer stadiums in Florida and Texas, so people at least would have had drinking water and they would have had a kit. And you give them a kit that's the size of a backpack, and in there you put food that can be reconstituted with the clean water you give them. And this way people at least would have their nutrition and water. And that would help them, but we didn't do that either. Also, we should have had portable elevated medical clinics that can go in and take care of persons. Do you remember I said on the air that you're going to see hospitals overrun because of all the chemicals are in there? Well, now flesh-eating bacteria has been on people because of all the toxins in that water. Now, that when it finally does dry out, and it hasn't yet, all that's in your soil. It's in your grass and the trees. It didn't go anywhere. So it's there. And the bad part is every one of these storms is the new norm. It's just the new normal. It's normal to go out and sit at 4 o'clock in the morning in a line that's already set up, people waiting for like their opening of a, you know, Apple store with a mosquito net over them and a lawn chair because the filling station opens at 6, and you're going to be there till 10. You're going to spend all those hours just waiting to fill up your car. Why don't they have a portable generator at every one of those filling stations? Why didn't they have backup in place? They never do. They didn't with Sandy in New York. They didn't do it at Katrina. They didn't do it in either of these two storms, and they won't do it in the future ever. We are incapable of doing anything that is both reasonable and responsible. That's because of the politics of bureaucracy and the politics of ideology. So you're on your own, but that's okay. I'd rather be on my own and know how to survive than be with people who are waiting for someone to rescue them, and that rescue comes too little and too late. To give you an idea, 80% of the victims of Hurricane Sandy are still waiting to be compensated by their insurance companies. Why? Because the insurance agencies have lobbied Congress, given money to the legislators, both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, all to their benefit. Then we shouldn't have those private insurers. We have, you should have universal catastrophic insurance. But also, we've got to understand, and here's a question just for you to think about, why is it that nothing will change? Nothing in preparedness will change. The infrastructures are a wreck to begin with in America. They're not going to change. And people will go right back and rebuild where they shouldn't be living to begin with. So when this happens, and it's going to happen, by the way, we've never had two category four storms hit America within 10 days in our history. That is the new norm. So we'll expect this year more, and next year more. So I see two things happening simultaneously. No change whatsoever. Nothing. Because people hate change. They despise it. They'd rather rip your skin off than to do anything that makes sense. I've been talking to my neighbors. I take them, you know, water and food, whatever they need to help them. And I ask them, what'd you learn from this? Oh, you know, it's tough, you know, but we're tougher. You're tougher than a Category 4? No, that's not toughness. Another word for it. Don't want to make a person that's lost something feel worse. So you just say, okay, good. But we're not going to do anything. We have never done anything. We never will do anything. We're incapable of change because we're not conditioned to change. We're not conditioned. We have not been propagandized to get ahead of things. We only follow what we're told. So we feel the comfort in mass, the comfort in predictability. So I see those who are going to change moving. Not immediately. They'll get back up. They'll get their, you know, the homes rebuilt and the roofs repaired, and then they're going to move on. And that's the smart thing to do, because it is my opinion, and I'm going to be out there. Within a year from now, I will have moved, sold my home for the last 22 years. Not that it can't withstand a storm. I withstood a Category 4. And I designed and built it with backup systems, wells and generators and all that. But when you see the destruction it does, and you think, wow, that took 22 years for that to grow, and it was gone in an hour. Pile 6 foot high, the size of a football field. You ask, how many times can you dodge the bullet? And I don't believe that I want to play the role of Christopher Walken in the end scenes in The Deer Hunter, where he's in a Saigon bar, doped up, drunked up, and spinning a bullet in a chamber because he's lost the meaning of his life. You're going to see a mass exodus out of Texas, not of the rich, but of the working class and the poor. But in the interim, you're going to have the massive amount, hundreds of thousands of people who are unemployed or underemployed going there because there's another 3 years of work, 3 to 4 years of fixing what has been damaged in those two communities, Texas community and Florida community. Now, when that exodus starts, you're going to have resistance, because if people start leaving there because it's not sustainable, the value of real estate will just collapse. With that, will collapse the tax base. And as a result of that, there won't be public services as readily available or able to help. And Miami, there's not going to be a Miami that's going to be habitable. It's impossible for them to move a road back and elevated 6 feet. That would cost $100 billion. They don't have that. And it would take a long time to do. In the interim, the big buildings will start to crack at the base because the sand is going to be pulled out of the pilings. And when you got a surge that could go, had it hit the East Coast 20 feet up, then your first two floors are flooded, even if the people at the top are not. Yet they dodged the bullet this time, relatively speaking. They won't in the future. So you're going to see the worst fires in Montana's history right now. When did you see it promoted on television? The worst fire in Montana's history right now going on. And in Idaho and Utah and Colorado and Washington State and Oregon State, Northern California and British Columbia, and in parts of Texas. So this is the new norm. So normal, we don't even report it on it in a news cycle. And all, there was one little minor environmental disaster. I think it was called Fukushima. Not a single thing has been done to keep the 100,000 tons of polluted water from going into the Pacific Ocean, polluting the entire Pacific, as if that didn't happen or if it's no longer important or relevant. It's extremely relevant. When you have the power to completely destroy an entire ocean and the aquatic life there. So for those who live in global living denialism, global warming denialism, then they're going to just see more of this. And that timetable is speeding up. Now, Richard Gale and myself are writing what should be the most comprehensive review of our environment. And I intend to offer that next week. It'll probably be two shows, an hour each day, 2 hours just on that one theme. But this shows you how bad it really is. When 40 million people are displaced from their homes, when 1,400 die, and not a mention of it in the mainstream media, because it was in India and the subcontinent, Bangladesh. So what happens in a world when 40 million people are thrown out of their homes as environmental refugees and no one pays attention to it? So you're on your own. And the moment that the storm is gone, the news is gone with it. And everyone's left over the next 4 or 5 years of trying to get compensated, trying to get the power will come back. And some places it'll be another 6 weeks. And in time, you'll be able to drink water, but you can't drink water. And by the way, when they say boil your water, you can boil water, but you're not going to boil out a lot of the stuff that's in water, like feces and certain parasites and giardia. What you should do is get the water and then boil it. Boil water will kill a lot of pathogenic bacteria and viruses and some protozoa. If water is cloudy after you boil it, let it settle and filter it through a clean cloth. You can even use a coffee filter. Then bring the water to a roiling boil for at least 2 minutes. But if you're out west above 5,000 feet like Denver or 1,000 meters, boil it for at least 5 minutes. Then let the water cool and then take a look at it. Now, what you can do is if water has a bad taste, you can just put a tiny pinch of salt to a liter of water, and that helps. But then put a tiny amount of bleach. If it's 1 quart, you put 2 drops of 6% bleach. If it's 1 gallon, you put 8 drops. If it's 2 gallons, 16 drops, or a quarter teaspoon. If it's 4 gallons, 1/3 teaspoon. If it's 8 gallons, 2/3 teaspoon. And what you do is that disinfects everything. And then you let that sit for 2 hours. Now, then you put it through a water filter. Now, once you put it through a water filter, then it's fine to drink. So they should have had water filters by the million, and they didn't. That would have been a good thing to have invested in, but that's not where they put their money. So that's how you know your water is then clean to drink, because restaurants are saying, oh, yeah, we can make a pasta. We boiled our water, and I say, yeah, and you don't want to know what's left in the water that can still make you sick? So boiling the water in and of itself does not mean it's safe to drink. So when you do these things, you have a chance. But I'm going to be doing more in depth tomorrow night, 7 p.m., part 2 of How to Survive Any Disaster. So you won't want to miss Progressive Radio Network, 7 p.m., the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'll be taking calls also. I'll be addressing your questions, no matter where you live, no matter what disaster you're facing, of how to survive these things and what the future looks like. Because in a lot of places, over the next 3 years, you'll see the exodus. You'll see the collapse of real estate value. And you will see how inhospitable nature is when you live in the wrong place at the wrong time in history. But we have solutions, and I'll share those with you. Thank you all for listening. I'm on the telephone and putting it all back together again. I'll see you tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.